Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Thriti Unrugar, whose latest novel is The Weight of Heaven. Earlier novels include The Space Between Us, If Today Be Sweet, and Bombay Time, nonfiction book, First Darling of the Morning, which is a memoir about the first 21 years of her life. Thriti Unrugar is a professor at Case Western and a journalist. This book takes place both in the United States and in India, and it's the first of your novels with American protagonists. Why did you decide to do that? And then we'll go into the opening of the book.
The idea of the novel came to me when I was touring with one of my earlier books, and a woman came up to me at a book festival and told me her story. Her story went something like this, where she confided in me that she had lost her son. He was an adult. The woman was older than the characters in this book, and she was American, and she had just returned from a fairly long stay in Thailand. And she was talking about the culture there and, you know, how helpful it was to her and her husband in healing from this horrific loss that they had suffered. Years later, that sort of became the genesis of this book. So it's not that I set out to write a book that had American characters in it necessarily. It just worked out that way.
Do you think you could have written a book with American characters before?
Oh, sure. I've spent my entire adult life. In fact, I've now lived more years in the U.S. than in India. So, in fact, I feel pretty confident writing about American characters and more precisely writing in the American idiom. It's actually where I'm a little shaky, is trying to recreate and reimagine contemporary Indian life because I don't live there anymore. In fact, my book that came out just before this one, The Weight of Heaven, was called If Today Be Sweet, and that, although the protagonists were Indian, certainly had a major character who was American.
The Weight of Heaven is about a young couple who lose their child and the pain that they're going through. Do you have friends who've lost?
I don't, thankfully, have friends who've lost their child.
Because I do, yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned that I was a reporter for many, many years, and this is certainly a subject that I have covered both in terms of feature stories, but also, you know, in terms of breaking news. I mean, I've very often been put in those situations where I've had to talk to people who have either recently lost a child or, you know, several years ago. So it's an issue that I'm very familiar with. And when I was writing this book, I was very, very aware of really the additional responsibility as a novelist that goes into writing about an issue this sensitive.
When you say the additional responsibility, what do you mean?
I figure you always have some responsibilities as a novelist. You know, you're always trying to write work that has integrity, that is emotionally honest. People very often say that the death of a child is about the most horrendous grief that a person can suffer and encounter. And that was very much on my mind when I was writing, just the responsibility of getting it right.
Do you have kids?
I do not.
The characters come to India to heal in a way. They go to a town called Gerbaug, which I guess is not real because I couldn't find it
online. It's fictional. Sorry, I could have saved you the grief of looking it up. Yeah.
Why did you choose to create a fictional town?
Because there were things that I wanted to do in this town that I didn't want people cross-checking it to see if it was historically accurate or if it was accurate in a contemporary sense. One of the major themes of the book, other than, you know, Frank and Ellie's journey to India, is also about the confrontations that occur between Frank, who is in India to head this factory, and the local people there. So I created this tree, which, you know, in the novel, it seems to have some medicinal purposes, and the leaves of the tree are what Frank and his company are there for. They harvest these leaves, as you know. None of this really exists, so I had to make it up.
You have a fictional company called Herbal Solutions, which has leased from the Indian government this orchard, which the inhabitants have been using for years on their own, both as firewood and for healing capabilities, right. Mostly as firewood, though. Is there a specific analog in India or even Thailand to that particular event?
Oh, very much so. I mean, as you know, most third world countries are struggling with this issue right now, which is the issue of property. Is it ethical? Is it morally right for a company? And, you know, in most cases, these are huge global corporations. They're multinationals. You know, owning land or natural resources thousands and thousands of miles away. I mean, in certain circles, this is an issue that's being debated all the time. So I was very much aware of the fact that I was writing about something that was topical in that sense, and yet giving it a kind of fictional cast to it by talking specifically about these leaves and these trees.
In India, specifically, I mean, we have the story of Enron building thousands of useless dams, forcing thousands of people, millions of
Absolutely.
People off their lands.
Absolutely.
What's curious here, of course, is this is a, quote, new age company with fairly enlightened people. In India, do you know of a specific instance similar to this?
I don't know of any specific instance similar to this, but as you just mentioned, I mean, we know that this kind of exploitation of not just labor, but natural resources happens all the time, all over the world. And it was a deliberate choice to not have Frank be part of some major corporation. I guess one of the things I wanted to say in this book is that even with the best of intentions, and I really do believe that Frank and his business partner go into this village with good intentions, but even with the best of intentions, when the power differential is as acute as it is, you know, between sort of villagers who have led pretty much a tribal existence until quite recently and an American company, that invariably there's going to be a clash of cultures.
Thriti Umrigard, there's another clash going on here, which I found fascinating, which is the relationship of Ellie and Frank, the Americans, to the Indians, because woven through the weight of heaven is post-colonialism.
Very much so. That's a very accurate reading of the book. To me, globalization is simply a glorified form of, frankly, colonialism or imperialism. You know, it's just imperialism with a different face, if you will. So it's something that I'm very much aware of, not just from living in India, but also just from my readings. One of the things that I think is interesting in this novel is that Frank's relationship with what has happened to him in his personal life, his inability to come to terms with this horrific loss that he has suffered, in some ways parallels his relationship with India. You know, grief has acted on Ellie and Frank in entirely different ways. In her case, it has opened her up in some ways. It has made her more sensitive to the suffering of others. In his case, it has narrowed him. It's made him put up walls. And these walls don't really come down in India. In fact, they get even a little higher. And he begins to feel a kind of contempt for the local culture, simply because he has absolutely no understanding of it and certainly no acceptance of it. He brings American values to a country that's quite different than America. Ellie, on the other hand, I think, learns to love and appreciate India on its own terms without too much judgment.
One thing that kept occurring to me, and maybe you can straighten this out, in this book, Weight of Heaven, we've got the relationship between Ellie and an upper-class Indian woman, her best friend Nandita, as well as her servant Edna. In your book, The Space Between Us, you have the relationship between an upper-class woman and her servant. On top of that, you've got the old Indian idea of castes. And I'm just curious how this all relates in terms of how they relate with each other.
Quite honestly, not much at all. And,
okay.
I'll tell you what I mean by that. This happens to me at book readings all the time where people come up and say, The Space Between Us is a novel about the caste system, right? And I say, no, it's not. It's really simply a novel about the class system. And in that sense, I think it has some universal appeal because, I mean, certainly we have classes in this country too, and I can very easily transpose some of what happens in The Space Between Us into an American context. And I think readers, imaginative readers, have done that for themselves.
Upstairs, downstairs.
Very much so, very much so. So the main character in The Space Between Us, who's Sarah, is this upper middle class Bombayite who's not a Hindu. And the caste system is something that's really particular to the Hindu faith. She is a Zoroastrian or a Parsi who have never had at least a kind of ritualized caste system. It's a moot point. It's simply a book about class differences.
And where does caste play? I didn't notice any sign of caste in The Weight of Heaven at all.
That's because there isn't, really.
Okay.
If the book had really been from the point of view of the villagers of Kirbag, then you would have noticed these kinds of distinctions more, perhaps. But since the book is mainly told from the point of view of Frank and Ellie, and to some extent from the point of view of Prakash and Edna, the couple who work as housekeepers, and they have an interreligious marriage. You know, Cass really does not come into it, other than the fact that there are some hints in the novel where you learn that because Prakash, a Hindu, has married a Christian woman, he, in some sense, has become an outcast.
He's become an outcast, but it's never clear that it has anything whatsoever to do with the old Indian caste system.
It's not, strictly speaking, the caste system at all, but the fact that he has not married a fellow Hindu has only acted to marginalize him even more.
Well, you grew up in a Parsi, which is Persians who came into India household,
right,
which means you were separated from the caste system
very
yourself.
Much so, yes.
And, of course, Ellie and Frank in this novel are separated from the caste
yes.
system, and the protagonist of The Space Between Us is separated from it. From your perspective, granted you went to a Catholic school
right.
and you left at the age of 21, did you see much in the way of caste distinctions?
You know, I really didn't, because as you mentioned, I grew up in a non-Hindu household. I grew up in a upper-middle-class household. I went to a Catholic school. I grew up in probably the largest, most cosmopolitan city in India. So I had a very urban upbringing and education. So it was not something that I came into direct contact with, which is not to say, I don't at all mean to suggest that the caste system is dead or it doesn't exist. It very much does. But it's becoming, I think, increasingly a phenomena of the countryside, of the villages, as opposed to the cities.
And I noticed that in the labor troubles that Frank is going through, there didn't seem to be much mention of religion either, Hindu or the American religion
right.
either. It was just purely class.
Well, in my limited experience, I feel like the religious debate is always cooked up by the politicians. You know, people left to themselves usually are looking for economic justice, for the most part, and political justice. And there have been many, many instances in India where Hindus and Muslims who supposedly hate each other don't and live side by side quite happily and certainly, you know, work in the same labor movements, etc. And this is not a book about those kinds of divisions.
Nandita at one point makes the comment to Frank, well, you know, of course, that Herbal Solutions, your company, had bribes in order to get the orchard. And Frank says, no, never. We never would have done that. In looking upon it as the writer, do you think Frank was wrong? Did he just not pick up on the bribes?
The way the novel unfolds, Frank comes into the action a little late. So it's entirely possible that Frank is an innocent. And look, a company situated in Ann Arbor, Michigan, 8,000 miles away, you know, there's no suggestion that the head of the company actually negotiated for these orchards himself. He's probably working through an Indian middleman, one would assume. He may not be aware, the head of the company may not be aware of how money has changed hands, but clearly for a deal of this magnitude to go through, believe me, money exchanged hands.
Some of the novel takes place in Bombay, particularly at a hotel called the Taj, which now I was not familiar with this hotel.
Right.
You've been there. What I found fascinating is how you were able to create the feeling of actually being in the hotel and in Bombay. I mean, it's very, very strong. Do you think it's because of necessarily your powers of a writer or just that Bombay itself is that vibrant?
Oh, Bombay is the muse to end all muses. Yeah, Bombay itself is so vibrant, so powerful a city that it definitely unleashes all kinds of creativity. And, you know, the Taj, I mean, it's unfortunate that in the Western mind, the Taj now will forever be linked to the terrorist attacks there in the fall.
Is it still closed or open?
No, I think it's open. I think it opened fairly quickly after that. But for those of us who grew up in India in the 70s, and, you know, even till today, the Taj is an iconic, you know, it's a grand hotel, and it's just beautiful and opulent and everything that you expect an iconic grand hotel to be. It really plays a very vital role in the cultural life of the city. Again, to qualify that, within a certain group of people, within a certain strata of society, it's a 5-star hotel.
I know Salman Rushdie, and I asked him about the Mumbai-Bombay difference, and he said, oh, I still call it Bombay, and a lot of people there still call it. And Mumbai is more just the governmental designation.
It's very much so. I can't get my mouth around Mumbai at all. For me, it's always Bombay. I think it always will be. The word Bombay to me just evokes, you know, it evokes a time of secular humanism and great intellectual ferment. You know, I'm talking mostly of the 60s and 70s. And the designation of Mumbai was simply, you know, a right-wing Hindu government came to power for a few brief years and decided that Bombay was the anglicized version of the original Mumbai and sort of went back to it. And again, perhaps this is a cultural and class difference that I should admit to, but for people like myself and like Salman, I think it's always going to be Bombay.
Do people there still call it that?
I think some people do, and many people have sort of bowed to the inevitable reality and now call it Mumbai.
You're listening to an interview with Thriti Umrigar, whose latest novel is The Weight of Heaven. The story itself leads to a very specific ending, which we can't go into here. Were you always aware that that would be the ending?
I think so. You know, the novel originated as a short story, and in the short story, it was pretty open-ended. It ends with Frank sort of asking himself a what-if question. But by the time the short story kind of transformed into a novel, I think I had a pretty good sense of what needed to happen. You know, there's a twist at the end, and then there's another smaller twist at the very end. I don't know that I knew about the smaller twist at the very inception of the novel, but I knew it pretty early on.
Which meant that you needed to take Frank to places where people normally wouldn't go. Well, that's pretty hard to do.
Yeah. For me to be able to pull off what happens in this novel, I really, really had to set it up very carefully. You know, it was simply a matter of credibility. Could you believe that this guy who starts out really as a good guy, I mean, I like Frank very much, even now, you know, I like Frank very much as a character. Is it possible for somebody to go to such a dark place? The way I answered that question for myself was, yes. I mean, grief can really, unresolved grief. I mean, if there is a quote-unquote takeaway message from this book, it's simply that grief, no matter how severe, must be dealt with. Because if it's not dealt with, it pops up a few years later in some darker form.
You have four or five main characters. Was there any character that you expected to be minor that just kind of pushed their way to the floor? I'm thinking in particular Prakash.
That's a great question. It's almost like you read my mind a year ago. That's yes, when I did the first draft of the book, I don't think I even gave Prakash his own voice. I don't think the chapters that now have him.
And he's the servant.
And he's the servant. He's the father of this young boy, Ramesh, who Frank grows so very close to. After that first draft was done and I was rereading it, I just realized that Prakash had to be a stronger presence in the book, that the book was somehow, you know, it was a table with just three legs, and I needed that fourth leg to balance it out.
Well, on top of that, in order for it to work, he has to be somewhat sympathetic, because if he's not, then it all falls apart.
I think that's true.
And the character of Edna, his wife, then becomes more problematic because she has to somehow fit in this.
Right, but Edna really came to me as a fully realized character. I feel a lot of affection, although she's a bit player, if you will. She has a, you know, very minor role in some ways in the book, but she was a character I really, really enjoyed drawing and developing.
And the character of Nandita, the friend of Ellie, you had a friend that you talk about in your memoir named Jess. Is that Nandita?
Yeah, I suppose so. You know, she's a composite. I mean, I had several friends who sort of were these bold, larger-than-life, radical women, you know. I think Nandita is based on most of them, but yes, certainly borrows something from Jess's quality.
She's also, in a way, the conscience of the book.
Yes, very much so. She sees the bigger picture, and because she spends so much time working as an activist with the villagers, she's privy to a side of them that Frank certainly isn't, because Frank is too busy playing, you know, boss man, basically. And Ellie, to some extent, is. Those people are visible to her. But because Nandita speaks the local language, because she has history with them, she's closer, and she can represent that point of view.
Thriti Umrigar, your career as a writer began in Bombay when you were very young. You wrote poetry, and then you wrote short stories. Did you grow up speaking primarily only English then?
Yes. I mean, we had another language called Gujarati at home, and I certainly spoke that with my family. You know, at school it was almost exclusively English, and amongst my peers, with my friends. You know, in college we would sometimes speak a very self-conscious kind of Hindi, but after two sentences, we would just automatically switch back to English.
Hindi was dealt with as if it was a foreign language in school?
Very much so. It was, in some sense, yeah.
Well, when you're in Bombay, I mean, how do you get around?
Well, you do learn it in school. You learn it from a pretty young grade. You know, you start in, I don't know, first grade, second grade. So you learn it as a language and, you know, process of osmosis. But remember, India is it has very complicated reality. I mean, on the streets, like in the marketplace, you don't really speak even Hindi. You speak a regional language, which is the language of the state in which Bombay is located, called Marathi. Basically, I was speaking four different languages. The Constitution of India, last time I checked, recognized 21 languages as official languages. And that's not counting the thousands of dialects.
When you were growing up, did you think that you'd eventually write, or was this just fun?
Oh, I always knew. I mean, I was always looking for ways to figure out how to make a living by being a writer. It never occurred to me that I would actually write and publish books. I mean, I became a journalist for a long, long time, frankly, because of a crisis of faith and confidence. I mean, there was nothing in my upbringing that led me to believe that I could have a successful career as a writer. It seemed preposterous. I would never say it out loud to anybody. And so I became a journalist because I knew that that was a way that it would still provide me with some degree of creative outlet once I got past covering the, you know, city hall council meetings, and it would earn me a paycheck. I literally remember the day I decided that I was going to declare myself as a future journalist.
And was that when you were still in high school or
much
after?
Much younger, much, much, much younger, maybe
really?
Age 8 or 9. I mean, I remember like stumbling over how to pronounce the word journalist, so I must have been pretty young.
I know that it was kind of by accident that you went to OSU, but what made you decide, I am going to go to the United States for college?
The short and simple answer is I decided that having a master's degree from a university in America would help me when I went back. Because in those days, this was the early 80s, there weren't too many people from India coming to study anything that was remotely the liberal arts. You know, it was mostly the stereotypical sciences. But the more complicated and, frankly, the more accurate answer is that after I finished my undergrad, I was sort of a little lost. I had geared up my life. I was going to join, at that time, the Times of India, you know, 2 days after graduation. And then as the time came close to that, I just realized I wasn't ready and I needed something else.
And from a fictional point of view, obviously reading Salman Rushdie changed your life.
Right.
But you also read a book called Lust for Life by Irving Stone.
Yeah. I was too dumb and young to know that it was a potboiler, you see. I thought it was a classic. I was like, 12 or 13 years old when I read it.
Did you read much in the way of Indian literature growing up then?
Not at all.
Really?
I mean, that's, Midnight's Children was really the first book that I ever read by an Indian author in English. Somebody put a copy of that book in my hand about a week before I left at age 21 to come to the U.S. That, in a way, is the tragedy of my education. You know, it exposed me to great literature, but none of it dealt with the reality of the country that I was growing up in. You know, in school you mostly read British, and at home you read American writers.
Did you see many Bollywood films or Hollywood films?
Both. I came from a movie-crazy family, and, I mean, we went to the movies all the time.
And in Bombay, do you mostly see Indian films, lots of American films? I don't know.
Yeah, it's changed. When I was growing up, we had tons of American films that came. I mean, there were entire theaters that only showed American movies. My dad, for instance, he was so contemptuous of Bollywood that he just refused to set foot. So with him, I would just mostly see, you know, American movies. But apparently, in the years since I've left, that's changed. And I'm sure there's some political reason for it, but there are fewer and fewer theaters that show American movies. The American movies that now play in India are the potboilers. I mean, they're the big thrillers, they're the Tom Cruise, you know, Mission Impossible. That wasn't the case when I was growing up. I mean, we saw some great small, you know, what today we would consider to be indie movies in India. And, I mean, they were very important to my growing up.
And television was just Indian then?
television yet. Television didn't even come to India until I was, I think, about 12 years old. So, you know, when I talk to my American peers and they talk about growing up with television, television plays absolutely no role in my life, even today, because it's just not a medium that I grew up with. So it makes me jittery and restless to just sit and watch TV.
When was the last time you were back?
Last year.
What kind of research specifically did you do when you were over there?
You know, mostly just visited a few villages because I grew up in the city in India. I mean, the villages of India, I'm a stranger to them. You know, I'm sure there are American tourists who might know village life in India better than I do in some ways. I just didn't spend much time in the villages when I was growing up there. So I just wanted to see what village life was like. So I just spent a few days visiting some places.
When exactly was that?
07, 08.
At that particular time, Bush was still president and Obama was still just running, and
right.
It was not clear that he would, maybe it was becoming clear he might be the next nominee. How did people in India view the election?
I remember in February when he won Iowa, I just remember sitting in my cousin's living room watching CNN, you know, with tears streaming down my cheeks. I just couldn't believe it. The Clintons are very well-liked and even loved in India. So for a while, there was a lot of skepticism about Obama and whether he could really beat her or not. But I felt in the time that I was there, I felt a slow shift in that tide of public opinion away from Clinton and more toward Obama.
And how did they think about Bush?
I remember several years earlier, I couldn't tell you what year it was, you know, being at a wedding in the family. And at dinner, I was seated next to an old man, an older gentleman who I'd never met before. And he must have just picked up on my American accent. They think I have an American accent. Nobody here thinks that. And he turned to me and without introducing himself, just out of the blue says, "Okay, tell me something. One time I can understand that you all made a mistake. But the second time, you know, that's when I really knew how deep this went." I just remember that moment so clearly because, you know, first of all, sort of the rudeness of that gesture, right? Sort of just pigeonholing and cornering a perfect stranger. And this was not some young, you know, activist. I mean, this was good old-fashioned, old Parsi gentleman. And he just launched into this. And India, despite the fact that during the Cold War, you know, Pakistan was in the American camp and India was in the Soviet Union camp, you wouldn't ever know that in sort of day-to-day man-on-the-street interviews, you know. Indians are almost reflexively, or used to be, pro-American. And Bush really cost us a lot of goodwill in that country. You know, what I tried to do was explain to him how close the election was, even the second time, that the country really is an evenly divided country. You know, the kind of nuances that people overseas maybe don't get and don't pick up. But the fundamental question still stood, which is, are 50% of you idiots? You know, how could you have done this?
Well, it's obvious in reading The Weight of Heaven that you could not write a book about intelligent people and have them not be appalled by the Bush administration.
Right.
What's interesting is that despite that, there is this American exceptionalism even among the liberals when they go to India.
Right.
Thriti Umrigar, now that you're here, you worked in journalism, you teach journalism, and this is a question about America. Newspapers are crumbling. What do you see going on?
I'm brokenhearted. I mean, I'm just really seriously worried about this. I don't know what this means. You know, for a long time, people were saying that just the medium will change. In other words, we'll stop chopping down trees and instead it's all going to be electronic. But I'm afraid that that's not the trend that I'm seeing. I mean, with the kind of cutbacks that we have seen, regardless of medium, I don't know who is going to be present to do all the things that good journalism does. Journalism as an industry has been in trouble for a good long time. But this economic meltdown that we are facing nationally and globally has certainly not helped at all. I wish I knew. I wish I knew. You know, I read something. I couldn't even tell you who said this, but somebody said that they believed that newspapers would basically remain a vehicle of the elite, or a privilege, if you will, of the elite. In other words, people in cities with great public transportation on either coast will still carry actual newspapers and read them. But for the rest of the country, it's just going to disappear.
Well, the problem, of course, is finding a model that pays for itself right. so that you could support good journalism.
Precisely.
And
nobody's found that yet.
Nobody has found it
right.
yet.
Right.
It may be that the way to find it is through the nonprofit world, which people are beginning to explore,
right.
I think.
The other thing that I've heard, another model that I've heard, is that you simply start charging a user fee, you know, much as you pay for cable services right now.
National one.
And then they just divvy it up according to the number of hits. But even that, frankly, seems a little unfair because then you're dividing profits based on, you know, how many hits a story is getting. And there's something about that that feels upsetting to me.
One other question I have for you. Back in the earlier days of the Bush administration, this goes back into the 90s, there was a lot of journalism that revolved around he said, she said, which became weird because you'd have a Democrat saying what's true and a Republican saying a lie, and then the journalist saying, well, here are both sides, fight amongst yourselves.
Right.
That's not journalism.
No, I think people have mistaken what objectivity in journalism means. You know, frankly, it's easy to do this, right? Because what it does is it puts the burden then on the reader to ferret out the truth from what both sides are saying. And I think it's just sloppy, lazy reporting when you do that.
Is it something you think that's been taught in journalism school, or is it just sloppy laziness?
I would be totally disheartened if I thought that there was a school in the country that actually advocated this method. I mean, I think what people do talk about is objectivity of news, you know, fairness, and I do think that that is essential to the craft, you know. I have pretty liberal politics, but I must say that I'm still enough of an old-fashioned journalist, I guess, that when I watch something like MSNBC, after a while I have to turn it off because I just feel like it's so one-sided that it doesn't feel good to me. I don't feel like I'm really getting all the facts. And anyway, that's not even giving me, they don't even claim to really give you the facts. All they're doing is mouthing off opinion. And after a while, I'm tired of opinion. I really just want news, you know.
What do you as a journalism teacher think about people like Judith Miller and what happened in the New York Times in the run-up to the Iraq War?
She just got co-opted by the power structure. And, I mean, she's a morality tale, I think, of how not to run a good career.
Do you think it's easier for you to write fiction than nonfiction?
It's more fun. I don't know about easier. I find it more interesting because in some ways, you know, I was at the L.A. Book Festival, and the last question that our panel got was, what do you say to people who say that nonfiction is, I don't know if he said more important or more interesting, because it tells the truth. And my response to the guy was, fiction well done will always tell a bigger truth than nonfiction ever can. That there is an emotional honesty and truth that a novel can give you, where it really gives you what's inside somebody's soul that perhaps nonfiction can't even come close to.
We started up by you talking a little bit about a novelist's responsibility. Do you see any political responsibility there, or just a responsibility of truth?
I do, but that's because I'm interested in political writing in all genres. You know, I consider myself to be a political animal. And in all my books, there are two themes that I think run through all of them, even though the subject matter is different. One is class issues. I'm very interested in sort of just exploring this whole issue of power. You know, who has power? How do they wield it? Against whom do they wield it? What is the response of the people who are being kept down? And the other is community. What makes community? What fosters community? What destroys community? And I think those two points are related, obviously. So, you know, I've been very amused. A couple of reviewers for The Weight of Heaven have said in kind of disc kind of tones about how the book moralizes and talks about, you know, the evils of capitalism, for instance. Well, for one thing, I think the book hardly talks about the evils of capitalism in that large global sense. It's not a manifesto, it's a novel. It's meant to entertain and hopefully educate. But, you know, in America, the political novel is a dirty word. I'm just amazed at reading these responses in these reviews. I mean, it's like it's, you know, it's not even 1/100th of the entire novel, and yet that's what they zero in on.
I saw in looking at one review somebody saying Bombay, she calls it, even though its name is Mumbai, and I'm thinking, No, she calls it Bombay because that's what she calls it.
Yeah, that kind of nitpicking. And there's an agenda, obviously, behind that nitpicking. I mean, it's one of the reasons, and people always say this, like somebody like John Steinbeck has completely fallen out of favor in the literary canon, and that's because he was a political writer. There does seem to be a kind of caution of fear. You know, if you want to really insult a novel, you say that it's a political book or it deals with political issues. And to me, all of life is politics. I mean, the way society is organized is politics. And if you're not writing about the times in which you live, then what on earth are you doing with your books?
Thriti Umrugar, are you working on another novel now?
Yes, I am.
Does it involve India again?
It does. It does. This one is, there's one character who has left India and has lived in the U.S. for a very long time. It's the story of these four women who were young activists in college in, I would say, the 70s, and have sort of lost touch with each other, and a crisis brings them back together.
In the United States or in India?
Well, the three of them are still living in India, but they make their way to the United States to meet the friend who is having the problem.
Do you see yourself ever completely leaving India behind in your work?
It's not impossible. It's nothing that I would plan on doing. I mean, I feel like that's rich subject matter for precisely the reasons that I talked about before. Bombay is an endlessly fascinating city to me. It's like all the great themes of literature, you know, you can find on a little street corner in Bombay. So I would never want to abandon it completely, but every book writes itself.
Do you ever see yourself moving back there to live?
No plans to do that at this moment, but never say never.
You've been listening to an interview with Thriti Umrugar, whose latest novel is The Weight of Heaven. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.